The Jeep Grand Cherokee 4xe plug-in hybrid is built for the best of both worlds. For the city buzz, for the call of the wild, for finding solitude, for sharing memories, for day trips, and for far-roaming adventures. Because with gas and electric capability, the Jeep Grand Cherokee 4xe inspires you to explore more, to explore it all. Tap the banner to learn more. Jeep is a registered trademark of FCA US LLC.
The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to the Athletic Women's Football Podcast. On today's show, we chat about gaming with Man City's Kerstin Kasperi and more. But first, we do head off to Wembley, where Charlotte Harper watched Chelsea beat Manchester United 1-0 to lift the FA Cup in front of a record crowd of over 77,000.
I'm looking out onto the Wembley pitch and the Chelsea fans are in their hundreds, waving their flags. At the start of the match, it was definitely the Manchester United fans who were dominating the conversation, and Manchester United dominated on the pitch in the opening minutes as well. But the Chelsea fans were louder throughout, and below, fireworks are on display. The Chelsea team lift the trophy. They go to thank their fans. They're applauding. Zazira Musovic is sitting down, posing with that FA Cup trophy as she hands it to Ann-Katrin Berger. The silver streams are all over the pitch. Tanya Oxtoby, the assistant coach, just chatting to Sophie Ingle, who has a Welsh flag over her shoulders. Another trophy for Chelsea, and they are celebrating in style tonight.
It's just really nice to be back. I'm enjoying it even more than before I got injured. I think when you get something taken away from you, you really realize how much you love it. So I think, yeah, the 5 months I was out, I was just really been working hard in the gym. So I will be as fit as possible when I will be ready. I think I use the time to try to see it as an opportunity to work with my mentality, my mindset, work a little bit more with like mindfulness, with meditation and stuff like this, to just like learn to be in the moment. I think that's something that's really important in football, that you don't get carried away, that you don't like get too much affected if something goes good or bad, but you're just like in the moment.
Me personally, it was just to be calm and try and settle the game a bit. So obviously I'm very chilled and laid back, but then it was for Pete to stretch and try and get in behind them. I think we were lacking that first half. We didn't really have any runners in behind them off Sam, so I thought that worked really well when it was Pinoy and Sam.
Well, we need to get to a point where we can play well and also, convert in that last half an hour. Obviously, it was 0-0 for so long, and then we lost out on something that sort of came out of nothing, really. So it's good to have good performances for portions of the game, but ultimately it's what happens between the sticks that make the difference, and today we just weren't able to do that.
Yeah, I hope so. We'll definitely build on this. We've come so close, so we've got that bit more hunger now to go again next year. But for us now, the focus is the league, and we want to finish on a high, so we want to get 6 points from our last two remaining games. And yeah, the mindset switches and it's a new week.
That was Ella Toon, Aoife Mannion, Sophie Ingle and Pernilla Harder. Charlotte's with us now, back from Wembley. I did see you in the mix zone. We were at completely different ends though, Charlotte. We're also joined by Carl Anker. For both of you, I know that you watched this final in detail. What was your overwhelming feeling having watched it in full?
It went exactly as
I probably expected it to go. If somebody said, oh, Sam Kerr popped up with the winner and Chelsea won 1-0, Man United had chances and they didn't take them, I'd probably say, yeah, sounds about right.
I'm disappointed because it went to the script. There was definitely, in the first half an hour, I felt Chelsea were there for taking. But it felt as if Manchester United were stunned by the idea of what Chelsea could be, rather than recognising that they had it within them to force the issue and win the game. By the time Sam Kerr did get the goal, United were stunned and they didn't really muster much anything after that. It was deflating if you're watching that from a United perspective, because you're going to go away from that feeling it was on.
We were all watching it from different points of Wembley Stadium, and a big shout out as well to our ticket competition winners, Tracy Smith and Victoria Basley, who I hope both enjoyed the experience as well. They will have been somewhere else completely as well. I think we've got all corners of the stadium covered for this one. I wanted to take it back to pre-kickoff and team news. It was brought to my attention that had Sam Kerr and Pernille Harder started together, which I think is what most people were expecting to see when the teams were announced, and it wasn't to be, Pernille Harder started on the bench. But had they done, that would have been the first time they'd started together since November in the 3-1 win over Manchester United. But as it was, we had to wait until Pernille Harder came on as a substitute to have the impact to link up with Sam Kerr. But it was interesting. I thought, first of all, tactically, what do you think Emma Hayes was thinking by not starting them together? Because it was very easy to see once Harder was on the pitch that the supply had been the issue, Charlotte.
Really good question. In the first half, United went man for man for Chelsea, and Chelsea really struggled. Jess Carter alluded to it in the mix zone. That was a really poor collective performance. Everyone's touch was a bit off. I don't know whether Emma Hayes wanted that bit more control in the midfield with Leupolz and Cuthbert, which you would expect from them, but Chelsea really, really struggled. And then by bringing Harder on, it just allowed Chelsea to go into that 4-4-2, and they had the strike partnership between Kerr and Harder. James got more on the ball on that right wing as well. So, yeah, I mean, fair play to Emma Hayes. Her tactical flexibility worked in the second half, but really, United could have been 1-0, 2-0 ahead in the first half. And it was only because United didn't take their chances that Chelsea were let off the hook.
I mean, 23 seconds in, Carl, and there's an offside flag, but Leah Galton did put the ball in the back of the net. And you thought straight away, wow, Manchester United are really up for this. They were the ones providing the high press. They were the ones looking like they were more hungry for it in that first half, weren't they?
Absolutely. However, I feel as if that goal was the best and worst thing for them, because it, you know, to use the old cliche, such a thing as scoring too early. I think it revealed there was a soft underbelly to this Chelsea team. And once United had that moment, they went, oh, could we try that again? Maybe not. And they just sort of didn't really seem to understand that Chelsea weren't pressing them as aggressively as they have in previous games. And while Nikita Paris in particular was trying to make things happen, there was a great separation between Ella Toon and Lisa Russo and the rest of the side. It was frustrating in that United scored, you know, in air quotes, scored after 25 seconds and then didn't seem to know how to repeat that idea again when things really mattered.
We can't ignore the save that Anne-Catherine Berger made either, Charlotte, from Millie Turner, of all players. I mean, you look at what she's been through, life-threatening injury that she's managed to come back into this Manchester United team, been a regular starter, starts in the cup final, up she pops. And it did look like that was going to be 1-0 Manchester United at the time. And from nowhere, there was just this reaction save from Anne-Catherine Berger. And at the time, you didn't really realise you'd be rewinding back to that point as much as I ended up doing when I was talking to her in the mix zone myself.
You've come to expect that from Anne-Catherine Berger, though. World-class goalkeeper. Saw it against Lyon in the penalty shootout in the Champions League semis as well. But United should have put those chances away. It wasn't just Millie Turner. Alessia Russo had a golden opportunity. And you can't help thinking, if Sam Kerr had been in those situations, she probably would have converted.
Yeah, I think that's the difference, especially in a cup final. You know, there's the adage, you know, finals aren't to be entertaining, they're there to be won. And there was just, United have not beaten Chelsea in 9, now 10 occasions. And if they wanted to do something that they've never achieved before, they had to be willing to try things that they've never done before. And they just didn't. They were just inhibited, perhaps by the occasion, perhaps by the fact it was Chelsea. But yeah, you can feel the frustration in my voice. It was there.
You also have to remember that Chelsea, they have internationals on the big stage, Champions League experience as well. Their team is littered with leaders who have that cash in the bank and they know when to deliver when it matters. And I think that's just that kind of steely grit and the belief that, yeah, we are going to win this. And it's hard as Manchester United debutant finalists to really have the kind of confidence to say, yeah, first time on this stage in front of a world record domestic crowd, we're going to overrule Chelsea. And they really piled the pressure on in the early stages. But I don't think you can underestimate the kind of mentality monsters of Chelsea. And although that seems like a cliche, they do just grind it out. And it can't be luck because they've done it so many times.
Mm.
From a United point of view, though, Carl, is there anything that you think Mark could have done differently? I know that there were some raised eyebrows when Nikita Paris went off. You've already mentioned her. She was having a cracking final, probably their star player. And then Ella Toon came off on 79 minutes for Aoife Mannion. Is there anything that you think that he could have done differently in the second half?
Go for it. It's the glib answer. I've spent the majority of this season asking for Skinner to give more minutes to Garcia. And while this has been a fantastic first team and a first team that's played many a minute together, and Skinner's got them to be a very finely tuned 11, perhaps even 13, there are, you know, numbers 14, 15, 16 that you're just wondering, had you given them more minutes earlier on in the season, could they be more effective later on? I think they just ran out of ideas after the half hour mark. So, you know, when Pernod Harder came on, I think 57. Not quite half time. And once that goal came in, they just didn't really know what to do. And they were overawed by the situation. To go back to what Charlotte said about mentality monsters, I think when you are an experienced team such as Chelsea, you know, once the game goes past the hour mark, you don't have to panic. And it then becomes eking out that extra inch. Whereas I suppose if you're Manchester United and you haven't yet played in the Champions League yet, you haven't necessarily, I mean, this is the first season where they've got past the FA Cup quarterfinals. I suppose the panic did creep in, and the panic made that extra 1-2% a little bit off. And in a cup final, especially against a team like Chelsea, you need that. So this will be a learning opportunity for sure, but I think it's going to gnaw for a little bit.
Carl and I were chatting in the press box in the first half, and the longer that first half went on, you could feel the momentum shifting, and you knew that the longer that it stayed 0-0, Chelsea were going to win it. Because you could sense the kind of Chelsea had their backs against the wall in the opening minutes, but gradually that kind of just, it was kind of like a balloon just going deflating.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it.
Yeah. Well, you've covered this as well in your article, Carl, about the need for United to be braver on the ball. So if anyone wants to read that, it is on the Athletic website. Look, from both of your points of view, I think you'll probably agree when I say that it won't go down in history as one of the great FA Cup finals, I don't think, in terms of performance. But what it did do is it had some moments and some statistics around it that will be remembered forever. So let's talk about Sam Kerr, because this is just more than a coincidence now. FA Cup finals, 2 goals last year, 2 goals in the final the year before, another winning goal this year. She has scored 9 goals in 9 games against Manchester United. I mean, she just loves playing against that side, Carl.
Oh, yeah. A scourge, as it were. I think in the first 5 minutes, Charlotte pointed out how Maya Letizia was enjoying some robust physical debate with Sam Kerr, shall we say.
She lost out in the end, I felt, but I think she tried, didn't she? She tried.
Yeah. The beginning of the game was the epitome of just let them know you're there early. So a lot of shoulder barges, a lot of elbows. And there was quite a few times where Kerr would drop deep and Letizia would follow. Very much, you know, the idea seemed to be, do not let Sam Kerr turn with the ball. Whatever you do, make sure she doesn't turn with the ball. I believe the halftime stat said Sam Kerr touched the ball 9 times in the first half. So it felt like job done. But this, it, you know, you just need to give Kerr half a chance. And sometimes even a quarter of a chance. She just has that ability to turn a quarter chance into a half chance and a half chance into a goal that the moment Harder comes on and that 4-4-2 splits the attention of the United centre-backs, it was coming.
And you can't have more of a mentality monster than someone who just consistently performs in the biggest of occasions. The final day of a WSL season, scores one of the best goals of the season last year, scores repeatedly in cup finals. She is the player for the big occasion.
I think it's 10 goals in 7 finals now.
Wow. Wow.
She loves
absurd.
It. You can see she loves the big stage. She loves kind of proving critics wrong. I saw a clip in the Mix Zone about her winning the Football Writers Association Awards. And, you know, Sam Kerr, by her standards, has not had the best season. Mm-hmm. But it's that deliverance when the chips are down and her team need her and she pulls out those goals. But you even see from the backflip, she's obviously enjoying her football and the reaction.
Which had been planned, apparently. She told me that Millie Bright and her had a conversation about that and she was always going to be doing a double backflip, which I don't think, it didn't get its true glory, did it, on TV? They didn't really manage to
the
get the replay
right. I quite enjoyed is that there's a little push Sam Kerr gives as she's winning away in celebration. So it's the, hang on, 1 second, I need to give the people what they've came here to see. Let me do the backflip. Which, I mean, it's one, for a person to have a pre-plan, when I score at the final, I'm going to do a celebration. Two, to have that celebration be as eye-catching as a double backflip. And then to do it anyway. This is what the very best players in the world do. And this is what they do when the finals happen.
I also loved her roar of celebration. I don't think I've ever quite seen Sam Kerr with some fruitful language being like, effing Chelsea, and grab the badge. Like, she loved it.
And ultimately, you know, this was the difference. I think when you're breaking it down and you're trying to wonder in the cold light of day on this Monday as a United fan, what was it? She was the difference maker. When you look at the shots, so United had 14 compared to Chelsea's 8. So they produce more shots. But when you look at what was actually on target, it's even pretty much. United 5, Chelsea 4. And this was in a game where Chelsea didn't have that supply to Sam Kerr for 45 minutes, for nearly an hour. And so I think that tells us a lot.
I think credit has to go to Pernille Harder as well.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
She has come back with a bang and she has really taken the game by the scruff of its neck when she's come on with a beautiful assist. And that's what we've been accustomed to see Harder do. Emma Hayes wanted her to run in behind with the defence, a bit more in energy. And given she scored a brace against Everton and then midweek against Leicester, I think, especially for the WSL title race, it's a huge shame that Harder missed the Champions League, because I think she would have been impactful as well. Mm. But she is a massive, massive boost to Chelsea in the real business end of the season.
Carl, let's just finish off by talking about United and the fact that they have got guaranteed Champions League football because of their performances in WSL this season. We don't know yet whether they're going to go on and win the title or whether Chelsea might just, in the end, edge it. But they have got guaranteed Champions League football. And could that make the difference going forward? They've not experienced that either, playing some of the best in Europe. Will that also raise the levels?
I hope so. I really, really hope so. Champions League has been the ambition for the last two seasons for this United team. They've achieved that. However, I think this season might have a slight tinge of disappointment if Chelsea go on to have good performances against West Ham and Reading and snatch a double. This is the best season United have had in their five-year period, however you want to describe it. And yes, they are probably a little bit ahead of schedule. But the benefits of Champions League football only go so far if the 13 or so players who have their contract situation up in the air can have that solidified a bit more. If it's Champions League, Annalisa Russo and Honor stay, happy days. I'm giving a thumbs up. That's not very useful for a podcast. If they're not, then I'm giving other hand gesture that you can't really see and is better for everyone involved.
We're going to round this off with something of a quiz, which I know our listeners love getting involved with. So wherever you are right now, if you're in the car, at home, doing a few tasks, try and join in with these, because you had some great statistics in your article about United's previous appearances at Wembley, Carl, in 1994 and 1996. It's got us in the mood for a stats quiz. So for both of you, chip in whenever you like. I know the answer to certainly this first one, one of them. Only three teams have won the FA Cup three times in a row now. Who are the other two?
Arsenal?
Yes, yeah, so Arsenal, because I was using that all day yesterday. They would be the first team since Arsenal did it in 2008. Yep. So I can reel that one off. So Arsenal, yes. Do we know the other, Charlotte?
Testing me here, Linz. Early doors. Southampton?
Yes. 1971 to 1973. And Arsenal... Did Arsenal do four in a row?
They did.
Yes, they did. So there we go. We have got both of the answers for that one. Let's see how you do with this one. Who was the last side to beat Chelsea in the FA Cup? Because they've got a run that goes back quite some distance. Also worth pointing out at this juncture as well, that Chelsea's run to the final was a lot harder, wasn't it? They had to beat Arsenal along the way and a lot of WSL sides compared to United's.
I'm going to say Arsenal again for that one.
Carl? I'm going to go for City.
Yeah, I'm going City as well. Everton.
Guess,
Everton is
guess.
The answer. Everton in September 2020, they lost 2-1 in the quarterfinal. That duped both of us. Man United are the first debut finalists since West Ham in 2019. Who was the last team to win their first FA Cup final? And we know it wasn't Chelsea.
The last team. Birmingham?
I could not tell you.
I would go Birmingham. I'm with you, Charlotte. I think Birmingham. Man City, though, it was against Birmingham. 2017, yeah, of course, Birmingham lost because Mark Skinner got Birmingham to that final. And if you remember, in the lead up to all of this, he was talking about how they'd put messages in the dressing room. Mm-hmm. He'd gone looking like he was in a wedding suit as well. Do you remember? And he said he wouldn't be doing any of that this time. Yeah. So Man City, actually, the victors in that one in 2017, were the last team to win their first FA Cup final. Only five players have scored in three consecutive women's FA Cup finals. We know that now includes Sam Kerr. Who are the others?
Well, given Arsenal have
your
played
success, yeah, you've got to go,
yeah, to I'm go gonna go for route. Their number nine, to that Kelly Smith. Surely she's got to be in there.
Yeah, she's got to be in there, hasn't she? I think there'll be another Arsenal player as well. Carl?
Oh, blimey, my mind's going absolutely blank.
How about the maestro Kim Little for Arsenal? Would she be up there?
Yes, Kim Little, 2009 to 2011. Kelly Smith was in there.
Okay.
And now we're going back further, which is probably why we're all struggling. There's one player here that I've heard of, and I have to say the first one we would have no chance. So Pat Davis, 1974 to 1976. And from 1986 to 1988, I would back Jen O'Neill to know this. Karen Walker was the answer. That's all of our four. That's us done for quizzing. I love having a little bit of quiz time with you both, though. Well done. It has taken the women's game a long time to get to the position where we have done for stats with a quiz like that. I mean, can you imagine trying to go through all the old archive notes? There wasn't really a record of anything for so long. I did a feature as well at Sky Sports, since they took over the TV rights, of how they had to just start their statistics from scratch in some cases. So it is very difficult. And on this topic, earlier I caught up with Steph Harries, who's managing director of the Women's Sports Group, who was part of the team that got the WSL analysed when it first launched in 2011. Steph, we're delighted to have you on the show. And I think this is a really intriguing area, actually, statistics in women's football and how they started and were collated. Now, you worked at Opta and Perform when the WSL began back in 2011. You helped to get all the stats set up for that. And I'm really intrigued to know where you began when you've just got a blank piece of paper in front of you.
Well, yeah, thank you. Lovely to be here. Thanks, Lindsay. Yeah, so Opta started collecting data for the FA at the start of that season. So the first edition of the league in 2011-2012. And actually, I know Opta collected at the time the data live at the key events level, and then fully collected in post, so the full live. So obviously there are two ways you can collect data. You can either be in stadia, or you can be watching on video link. So I think it was sort of done in stages. At the 2020-21 stage, that season, it was upgraded to F24, which is the sort of tier 13 highest level of data collection. So it's everything, you know, it's passes, assists, goals, obviously, you know, all the expected goals, the whole lot. It's the highest level of data, which is F24 is the sort of highest level which men's leagues are collected. Which enables, of course, much greater match analysis, because you can go into really sort of deep dive detail. Opta also had an in-ground correspondent from very early on to ensure anything that you might potentially miss on a live video feed there isn't. So they ensure that there's somebody in the ground. It's also worth noting, actually, that Opta have full historical data for the league at F24 level. So they then went back, and when it wasn't being collected at the highest level, they then went back to collect that in post. So that backfill project ensures really accurate, reliable, consistent data. You want to be able to print the story, provide the context. So that's really important in creating a clear quality audience proposition in output. It's essential to be living up to the standard that has been created for football coverage, certainly in this country. And if you're trying to develop parity of coverage, you need the level of analysis. And it's not just analysis, you know, it's match analysis, it's head-to-head, some vision on air. Talent need to have the information at their fingertips to be able to add to their opinion, coverage, commentary, presentation. And that's the way, you know, it's one of the very many elements of normalising women's football in the football landscape.
There will and have been disparities. I know for a fact that sometimes certain clubs say that it's a player's 50th appearance, and then within our own statistic packs, we weren't aware of that, or we think it was going to be at another time. I know that has happened this season. There was also an incident as well with the number of goals that Sam Kerr had scored at one point this season.
Yes.
So in your opinion, who should be the holy grail in this? I mean, the collective responsibility, of course, is huge. And I do think that clubs and maybe broadcasters need to be liaising more in that space. But would you say that Opta, because of the intel that you've already laid out and the system that was created and what goes into it, should that be the benchmark, and that should be the stats that everybody should go to first?
I think Opta are ultimately a market leader, and there's a reason for that. Just to pick up on your web responsibility, there is a responsibility of everyone in the ecosystem to put the best coverage and output possible. It's the number one, you know, global game, and therefore we all have a responsibility in that. It's also opportunity. We often talk about the women's game as a responsibility. Of course, there is a responsibility of us all to put out the best content possible, accurate and fact-finding journalism, interesting discussion that is based, as you rightly say, on accurate data and fact. But no one element of a chain is any more or less responsible.
Mm. Well, the beauty of these conversations that we have, Steph, is often it leads us to then want to explore other areas. And I think when we talk about statistics, I raised this with producer Sophie before I knew that we were doing this interview. I also think statistics are deeply rooted in betting. And if you can gamble responsibly, it is a huge area that's linked with sport. It always has been an intrinsic link. And in the women's game, there still aren't many betting markets, really. You know, I'm someone that loves women's football, and out of interest, I go to have a look. And sometimes, you know, it's winner or loser outright and maybe a top goal scorer, but there is certainly not that level of detail yet. So do you think that's one area that might actually grow going forwards?
I do. I think it's a largely untapped area. We know that, let's put aside the ethical debate about betting, but like you say, you know, gambling responsibly is the, you know, we're at liberty to do so. Obviously, the WSL is currently under the FA, and it will not be available for betting because the FA has said that is, you know, officially that won't be happening for as long as it's under the FA.
Right.
I was actually asked a really interesting question on a panel recently by a lady who I believe, I hope I haven't got this wrong, was from Lewis Football Club. But this brilliant question was, do you think, Steph, with your experience, that we as a community of women's football experts should make a difference and almost create a USP in women's football by not making it available for betting? And it was a fascinating question, actually, because, you know, betting is a big business. And if you make the decision not to make it available for betting, I said, you know, I'm not going to sit here and make a comment on behalf of Women's Sports Group. The question is an interesting one. So from my own personal perspective, if you take that decision as either a football club or a league, you must take that knowing that you are cutting off a huge potential revenue stream. Mm-hmm. That is the point. So it's a business decision and it can be led by any number of things, but, you know, it's a huge area of growth. What we do know is that it is a largely untapped area, but we do know that the numbers of female bettors and those betting on women's sport, and they're two very different things, which are, you know, of course, there are overlaps. It's largely untapped, but we know they're increasing. So the fact that you cannot find, I'm the same, by the way, you know, you can't seem to find the odds. I have a friend that went into a betting shop, would you believe? So not even online bet, went into a betting shop on that opening game of the Women's Euros, England, Austria, in Manchester, and went into a bookies and asked for the odds on the game. And they had to go out the back, despite it being a big display in the window about the Women's Euros, had to go out the back to dust off this big old book.
You can just imagine it, can't you?
You can. And it's kind of, you think, goodness, you know, in this day and age, that's what's happening, really. So you've got no odds checker or market creator or, you know, bet builder that is extraordinary, you know, because it's ultimately untapped revenue. And that was what I was trying to say sort of earlier. So your point on responsibility, which is absolutely right and fair, there is a huge responsibility of us all to ensure that the product and the output and the coverage is of a certain standard. But there is also the commercial opportunity around women's sport, which is inarguable. So when you don't have the odds readily available for a massive women's football match, more for you, because, you know, you're missing out on huge potential revenue stream.
Couldn't agree more, because I honestly think that that's now planted a seed for us to explore this a little bit further, but really appreciate your insight into WSL's formation at the very beginning, your time with Opta and Perform. Thank you very much, and all the best with your role now at Women's Sports Group.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
That was me speaking to Steph Harries. If you have any thoughts about that, do get in touch. You can use the hashtag AthleticWFP on Twitter. Coming up, it's a huge week in the WSL where the title and relegation battles could be decided. We'll get on to that. Ahead of the Manchester derby, producer Sophie caught up with Man City's Kirsten Kasparai, but they didn't just talk about football. You may remember last month we spoke about getting more inner city teenage girls into the game by targeting mothers, but also by making gaming more inclusive. Well, Kasparai is a keen gamer, so take a listen to this.
Kirsten, thank you so much for joining us on the Athletic Women's Football Podcast. We're really excited to have you on this week.
Well, thank you for having me.
I want to talk to you about gaming in this interview. I've heard you're a big gamer.
I am a very big gamer, yes.
Amazing. What kind of games are you into?
It kind of like depends in what mood I am. I've got like different, I've got a PlayStation, a Nintendo Switch, I've got even got VR set.
Nice.
So it kind of depends what mood I'm in.
Are we talking football games or...
Yes, I do love football games. I'm not the best at FIFA because I used to get absolutely battered by my younger brother. So I do have some trauma when it comes to FIFA. But I love all types of games. Like, I don't really have any specifics. I love the diversity in between the devices that I have. So I can't point it, like pin it down on one favorite.
Do you ever play football games against your teammates at Man City?
No, actually, I don't. No.
Is that you don't want to see them lose or something?
No, it's not necessarily that I don't want to lose. I mean, I don't think loads of girls actually do game as much as I do. I think I'm one of the only ones, as far as I know. We do sometimes during like commercial windows get allowed to play some FIFA together. And that always brings out the best in us, but not in my free time, unfortunately.
It's quite interesting you say that you're kind of one of the only ones who plays, because the reason I wanted to talk to you about gaming was we were chatting on the podcast a few weeks ago mm-hmm. about how there aren't that many young girls who play video games and things like that. And they were saying, actually, if you could get more young girls to play football video games, that kind of thing, yeah, it might bring more people into the culture of football. I don't know if that's something you've thought about at all.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at esports teams, I rarely see any women or girls. So I would tell anyone, everyone to game. I mean, I love it. I grew up with it. I think my brother's game because of me, which is...
Oh, that's interesting. Most people think you're around, yeah.
Yeah. Because they're both younger than I am, and I was the first one to get my PlayStation, and I just remember trying to kick them off all the time because I couldn't even get on.
How did you get into it then?
I don't know. Like, I had a lot of guy friends growing up. I think because they did it, I did it as well, and I really enjoyed first on my iPad, like stuff like Subway Surfer, and
mm-hmm.
later on I was like, oh, I want to get a PlayStation. I want to play video games with my friends, and I just generally really enjoy it.
I was just wondering, when you were younger and you're playing these games, did that have any influence on whether you wanted to play football, or was it quite separate?
No, not really. It was quite separate. I mean, I did play a lot with the guys that I played football with as well. So we had a little competition, obviously, in training, but I also have training with a little FIFA competition as well. But it didn't necessarily get me more into football, but my general understanding of trying to pass, trying to play the positioning game, that really, really helped me in my development, I think.
If you're playing a football game, does it help that you're a footballer? Does it give you anything extra?
I do believe that it helps with your insight in the game. Like, you like passes. I mean, here at City, we talk a lot about FIFA goals, which I now know what that is about, because I know, like, you keep passing, and literally at the last second, you try and get a tap in. So when stuff like that's being said, I'm like, yeah, I know what you guys mean. So I do think, like, for your general understanding of football, FIFA is great.
So they say score more FIFA goals if you can, or something like that at training.
Yeah, yeah.
That's brilliant. I love that. I wonder how many other people on the team are really into that and get that kind of reference. Is it a lot of you or not?
I mean, at this point, everybody knows what that means. But the first time I heard it, I was like, oh yeah, I immediately understand what that is. Whereas I can understand with some other girls that don't play FIFA or don't play video games at all. But like, I don't know what that means, but we'll see. But I think everybody now has a general understanding of what it means to score a FIFA goal.
How do you think we can get more girls into, especially football gaming? Because I feel like FIFA is such a big window, isn't it? To kind of getting interested in football and wanting to play, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, FIFA is, I think it's one of the best, like most biggest games there is. It's it gets sold so many copies every year, and people keep buying it. I feel like if girls enjoy it and if girls want to do it, they should. And they should feel free to. And I would always say, you should, yeah, if you want to do it, you should do it, because I love it. And it gives me a lot of just a fun time out of training. It just helps me relax. And if you want to do it, you should do it. And I don't really know what else to say to them.
I think people hear you speak about gaming and stuff like that. I think that is going to inspire young girls to kind of get involved in that side of the football culture. So that's really great. And obviously you inspire on the pitch as well. I wanted to ask you briefly about the game against Liverpool. Obviously really tough. Your caption on Instagram, a Liverpool of tears, I thought was kind of spot on. It must have been really hard to take that.
It was really hard to take. I think we were all gutted after the game. We were just not on it. We can't really say anything else than that. I think we had quite the off day, and fair play to Liverpool. They did quite good, I think. They did good. So yeah, for us, it's obviously, yeah, we're gutted. And I think a Liverpool of tears, even though not everybody got what I meant, I think for me, that was how I felt. And I feel that was spot on. So yeah, I think that said it all.
I guess as a team, you're kind of coming to the realization that that probably means that the title is out of reach. Does that mean the focus is kind of Champions League spots? I know you'll say you'll just focus on the next game, but has there been a moment of realization as the team for that, or not really?
I think we didn't want to think too much about potentially maybe not becoming champions. I think for us, we want to do everything to win the upcoming two games, and we'll see where we're at the end of the line. And, you know, loads of crazy stuff has happened in football before. So I will be the last one to say that we will be out of the title race. I'll absolutely be the last person to say that. And I do think that if we win the upcoming two games, and we do still have a good chance to finish quite high in the ranks. So that's all we're focused on. And yeah.
The next game coming up, obviously, the Manchester Derby. Yeah. You played your first one last year, didn't you? Which I can imagine was a great event for you. You're probably up against Leah Galton, Manchester United. Mm-hmm. How are you going to approach that one?
Well, the Derby is special, and it was special in the Etihad, and I'm pretty certain that the away of all the Derby at United, that the stadium will be full as well. So hopefully we'll have a good atmosphere. I think we as a team have a very good plan, and it will be up to me to stop Leah from scoring, which has been doing a lot this season. So that'll be a good task for me. I really am looking forward to it. I'm actually glad that we don't have a game this weekend, because we really want to get out there and set things straight.
That was producer Sophie speaking to Man City's Kirsten Kasparai. We don't often speak about gaming. Charlotte, you've been on this show many times. I can't recall a time when we have. But it is a gateway, isn't it, to this younger audience?
Absolutely. When we spoke to Salon at Football Beyond Borders, it was a avenue that we really saw as a kind of cross-culture to get girls into football and into gaming. I know a lot of the players enjoy it as well. And I suppose, yeah, growing up, I'd play with my brother, but it was never a social thing to just do with my friends that were girls, or even kind of like EA Sports. It was always with the boys. So a definite one to tap into.
And Carl, do you think there's some crossover here when we look at on-pitch performances? Because in this interview, Kasparai, she mentioned how it's influenced the way that she sees the game when she plays, which I thought was an interesting take, because playing, you know, FIFA or any of these games, we all think it's just a pastime, but it could actually be influencing the way that you're playing as a professional.
I think it's definitely had help in the appreciation for some tactics and statistics. You know, I often say when I was growing up, you know, a midfielder was a midfielder, whereas now, you know, your average teenager has an appreciation between what a 10 is, what a box-to-box midfielder is, what a deep-lying number 6 is. The fact that now younger generations think of a 6 as a defensive midfielder rather than a centre-back in England is in part due to FIFA's influence, or you know, what is now going to be called EA Sports FC. So that has helped also. But also in the thing of being a former gamer during my teens, I've lost more than one Sunday League game because I was probably up a bit too late playing FIFA instead of going to bed. So yeah, all things in moderation, I should say.
I hope on Saturday night that all consoles are removed from Kirsten's reach. She doesn't want to be getting distracted, does she, on Saturday night? Mind you, the Sunday game doesn't kick off till late. She'd still be okay, I think. What about these huge WSL games then? So the Manchester Derby, Chelsea hosting Arsenal as well. We could see the title being decided without us really getting to see a trophy lift until the final day. And that would happen if Chelsea win this midweek game against West Ham. That's their game in hand. They then go above Manchester United and they've managed to peg back the goal difference as well. So then should Manchester United lose the Manchester Derby against City, which is a game that takes place after Chelsea host Arsenal, which if Chelsea were to win that one, would see the result of the Manchester Derby, meaning that Chelsea could already be decided. That isn't what we want to happen though, is it, Charlotte? Don't we like it when a result happens and we're there and we can see it with our own eyes?
Either way, it'll be entertaining for two weekends. 12:30 kickoff on Sunday, Chelsea Arsenal. And if they win that, then yeah, big pressure, big, big pressure on Man United this weekend to come up trumps against Man City. Of course, the neutral would like to go down to the wire for the last weekend, see where the trophy heads on the motorway. But Man United, I think, could be susceptible to losing against Man City.
Don't say that.
Of course,
please.
They're at home, and you know, Lee Sports Village is a hostile environment to play in. But yeah, that they'll want to take it down to the wire. They won't want to roll over easily, especially after the season that they've had. But it's going to be really tight.
Speaking as someone who's covering United, I very much want all of this to go down to the final wire. I very much want Paul Konchesky to help mastermind some form of dastardly victory and or a draw. So
perform
such a scenario
though this year,
happen.
Carl. It's going to be
I know. It's Chelsea are feeling very foreboding, and I think the manner in which they caught up on that goal difference is spooky. Very, very spooky.
Rhianne Skinner lost her job at Spurs for similar form.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Mark Skinner was very to the point when he was asked if he thought the FA Cup result could affect either team in their title race. And he was like, nope, this is very much going to be a one-off. We're not going to think about how possibly beating Chelsea could derail their title chase. And we're not going to think about how any possible result for us would have anything. However, there was just something about the somber manner in which United took their silver medals that has got me quite fearful for how this season's going to end. I'm really hoping I'm completely wrong and I'll be utterly embarrassed the next time on this podcast and United lift the Super League trophy.
We have to just hope there was something really good in those pizzas in the mix zone, Charlotte, don't we? As they were walking through. we haven't covered Arsenal. What do you think about them and their chances of potentially doing something against Chelsea? I think a lot of people with the injuries and what's mounted up have written them off being able to do anything, but actually they keep finding a way.
It's a pretty damn good time to play Arsenal, given their depleted squad. And we've seen the depth in Chelsea's bench as well. But remember, Arsenal got the better of Chelsea in that Conti Cup final, and mm-hmm. Chelsea were outmaneuvered tactically and physically. So Arsenal have done it before, just they're missing several key players.
Well, they're going to be looking at Marnham to be in the form that she's been in. I think Katie McCabe's a crucial player, isn't she? Leah Velty's gone a little bit quieter than she was. They've got the quality in a starting 11, but it's coming down to the benches and what you look to do in the second half, and just running out of options, really. And Gio didn't look good in the last match at Crawley. It looked like that could have been quite a bad injury.
A bit like the FA Cup final, you get this horrible feeling that if Arsenal don't start well, if they don't have a really good opening half hour and possibly get a goal or two, the game will just drag out and Chelsea will find a way to make them submit.
Do we all think that Spurs against Reading is the relegation decider? Is that the one that we should be watching, where we know that the outcome of this one, if there is a winner of any degree, then really we know who we're saying goodbye to from WSL?
Yeah, if Spurs win this, that'll take them up to 17 points, 6 points clear of Reading at the bottom of the table. And you think, yeah, that is a huge game for them. Leicester, core, they took a thumping against Chelsea midweek as well. But I would think Reading will be heading down. But Spurs against Reading on Sunday, that's going to be the somber one. But, you know, Reading could pull something out of the bag against Spurs, and they're clinging on.
Maybe one, once that is confirmed, for us to revisit down the line, because with the men's team getting relegated as well, I don't know, I just worry for mm-hmm. Reading, full stop. Once the WSL is decided, players can bring their focus back to the World Cup. There are continuing wranglings about when players will be released for that one. But Charlotte, you've revealed on The Athletic that players' families are getting support to travel out there. So can you tell us more about that?
Yes, so the FA will give each squad member who makes Serena Wiegmann's World Cup team £10,000. That's for them to give to whoever they wish, presumably close family and friends, to book flights to Australia, given how far away it is and how important that home crowd was in the Euros and how instrumental it is for players to see their family and friends and keep them fresh and a sense of normality out in Australia. But with flights, kind of a return flight in excess of £1,500 from London, it's an expensive trip for family and friends, especially as England will be flying between Brisbane, Adelaide and Sydney for their group stage games. So the FA have chipped in. It's not to be spent on accommodation though. And it's tricky time for squad members as well, because obviously they won't find out until late May, beginning of June, whether they're going to be included.
Yeah, and then how far does that £10,000 go if you
exactly.
want to take, you know, three or four family members? Because flights and accommodation, it's going up the closer and closer you get to the tournament starting.
Exactly, Linz. A step in the right direction, but how far is it going to go?
The organisation part of this tournament hasn't impressed yet, has it, in terms of the announcements for rights deals, the announcements for squads. I don't know, it just all feels a little bit late. That's it for this week's Athletic Women's Football Podcast. Do check out Carl and Charlotte's pieces on The Athletic this week. Katie Wyatt did a nice one as well, focusing on the fans after that record crowd for a domestic women's game. So if you'd like to read more about that, find her article online. Charlotte and Carl, thank you. Carl, I've got to give you a moment to shine here, because we saw the BAFTAs, Kate Winslet giving her speech last night, and we've seen quite a lot of women's football being celebrated as well, with Whisper picking up an award. You yourself are at the BAFTA of the Book Awards, you tell me later.
Yes, I'm off to the Nibbies tonight, the British Book Awards. The book I wrote with Marcus Rashford is nominated for Best Children's Nonfiction. So yes, hopefully a good evening, and hopefully get to meet some other fantastic creatives about another wonderful year in publishing.
Amazing. And we're going to keep everything crossed for you. Do you have a speech planned?
No, but I'll probably start doing some bullet points now, shouldn't I?
I would. After we've just said goodbye, that's the first thing I'd go and do. Just write a few things down, Carl. I don't want you being caught on the hop after you've had a few beers.
Okay, thank you. I'll take that doing.
That's my words of advice for you. Producer Sophie, thank you very much as well to you. I know you did that interview this week. For you as well, for listening, make sure you tell us what you think using the hashtag AthleticWFP. The handles as well on socials, TheAthleticFC and @OffsideRulePod. See you next week when the WSL title and relegation may have been decided. Who knows? Who knows what we'll be talking about next week, but it will have relegation and title tagged onto it. Bye-bye.
The Athletic.